Fam, how's it going? Happy Friday. This is your host, Ross Bolin, and I have a special treat for you today on my other podcast, the Ross Bolin Podcast, which you have heard me mention many times. Obviously, it's comedy and humor centric, but we also get into mental health struggles. For those of you who are more familiar with me, you know I've dealt with a lot of anxiety and depression and substance abuse and addiction. So we get really serious. We talk life. We talk family, animals, serial killers, pirates, but I also bring on special guests who I find to be interesting that I think the audience would enjoy hearing from. And for episode 210 of the Ross Bolin Podcast, I was fortunate enough to get Mr. Steve Sciarrippa, the awesome gentleman who played Bobby Bacalieri on The Sopranos, Bobby Bacala. As you know, The Sopranos, a top three, if not number one TV show of all time for me. This was a very, very big deal. You'll hear the nervousness in my voice. It literally was like speaking to Bobby. So it's something. I wanted to share that interview with y'all today. Here, the Clam Fam needs to hear it. So without further ado, featured in episode 210 of the Ross Bolin Podcast, available in all the same places you listen to OCC, here is Mr. Steve Sciarrippa of The Sopranos and Blue Bloods and so much more. You got your first taste of show business as an entertainment director at the Riviera Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, where you actually ended up meeting your wife, which is my friend's cousin, and how we got connected is a small world. I've only been to Las Vegas once, and it nearly killed me. Speak to starting your career in the entertainment industry there and Las Vegas as a city a little bit, if you would.
You know, I moved out there like in the early 80s. You know, I grew up in Brooklyn and then I graduated from college and I moved out there in the early 80s. A friend of mine moved there. I had nothing going on. And I became a bouncer in some of the nightclubs there. So I was a bouncer. I worked at Paul Anka's club. He had a big nightclub there at the time. And then I worked my way into the hotel, and I was a maitre d', and I worked with a lot of comics. They had an improv there. So I was working with a lot of comics. So that was the first taste of it. It was all new to me, you know. And I'm working with a lot of comics, you know, Richard Belzer and Bill Maher and Rosie O'Donnell and Dennis Leary, and I could go on and on, you know, the people that I worked with, Rob Schneider, David Spade, you know. So I did that for quite a long time, 7, 8, 9 years.
And it's Las Vegas in the 80s. It had to have been an interesting experience, especially working as a bouncer.
Yeah, but it was much better. It was much better then. It was 350,000 people. It was a small town. You knew a lot of people knew each other. It was a different place completely. Nothing, you know, now it's like Times Square, Las Vegas, you know, it's a completely different deal, man. You know, back then you bounced around from hotel to hotel, you know, you would go see this guy. Now you can't even get down the strip, you know what I mean? You tell people, I don't want to sound, and I'm sure before me it was even nicer because I've heard those stories in the 50s and the 60s.
Right.
But this was 79, 80, 81, like that. And so it was a different place, just a small town kind of. And then it grew and it kept growing every 5, 10 years. And it just grew and grew and grew. It got too big, you know.
That's funny. It's always the old school Las Vegas people always say the same thing. It's, you know, if you were there in the 80s, it was the 70s that were the glory years. If you're there in the 90s, it was the 80s.
But the 80s were good. The 80s were good there. A lot of people moved in. A lot of younger people were moving to Vegas because there was jobs, man. You know, there's cocktail waitresses.
It's an exciting place.
Waiters and bartenders. I mean, you know, guys were making $500 a night in the 80s.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? They were making money back then when every, you know, when rent was $150, you know?
Right. So
you had all that dealers, and all young people were coming in from all over the country. And then it just grew and grew and grew. So from the hotel, and I was dealing with these comics, I was dealing with some other shows, and I started booking the lounge acts, and I started booking all this stuff. And then I was dabbling in the acting. A couple of the comics put me in little sketches and little things, and I started getting a little taste of that, and I liked it a lot, you know. So I took some lessons in Vegas. But and then when productions came into town, I wasn't pursuing. I mean, I was in my 30s, I had two kids, you know, a wife and two kids, and I wasn't pursuing it that hard. It was just more like a hobby. And then, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas came into town, and I got a role in that, and I got a role in Chicago Hope, and I was starting to get these little bit things, you know.
So what you know,
I got my state card.
You spoke to Fear and Loathing. What was your role in that?
I was I played a bouncer when Benicio del Toro and Johnny Depp went in to see Debbie Reynolds. You see me throwing them out, barging through the doors, and I rolled on the floor. I had a couple lines. I was wearing a white tuxedo, and I rolled on the floor with Benicio del Toro. We did that numerous times.
That's
you know?
Incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you know at the time when you were filming Fear and Loathing as one of your first projects that that was going to end up being such a like cult classic part of American
culture?
No,
but it was a big movie that it was a big movie everybody wanted to be in. And when I read for Terry Gilliam, we were actually shooting it in Vegas downtown, and I got to the set and I was waiting, you know, waiting there, and I met Depp, I met Benicio del Toro, and I waited for 3-4 hours, and they said, hey man, we're not going to get to you. It's not going to get to it. We'll do it next month in LA. And they said, we'll call you. And I went, they're never going to hear from them again. And they called me, and I went to LA, and we shot it at the old Ambassador Hotel, which is the place where Robert Kennedy was killed.
Wow.
That was weird. Yeah. So we shot it there. And it was funny. Johnny Depp stayed in character very much. He wore an earpiece. And there was a guy in the back, an English guy, feeding him the lines.
Wow.
And I didn't know. I was kind of green. I didn't know what that was. And he would, however he said the line, that's how Johnny Depp said the line. Hey, we're looking for Debbie Reynolds. And we used to romp with her. And whatever he did, he was reading the lines. For whatever reason, he was using the earpiece.
That is so funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then and Benicio, they were very nice. Both of them were very nice to me. And I've seen Johnny Depp since. But so that was, so then I did that. I was getting a bunch of little bit parts in Casino. I auditioned for Scorsese, De Niro. I didn't get that role, but then they kind of threw me a bone. And it was in a scene where Pesci stabbed the guy with the pen.
Right. Okay.
So
the shine box
like
scene.
If you could hear me say, Joey, look out, look out. And that's how I got my SAG card. I was in a scene with De Niro and Pesci, who was very nice, Frank Vincent. And that was like 16 hours and blah, blah, blah. But that's where I got my SAG card. And then I was, you know, I did an episode of King of Queens, an episode of this, episode of that. And then I was starting to get stuff. My agent would, you know, there was a guy helping me. He was a friend of mine. And I would drive to L.A. and I would get a couple of auditions, and I was starting to get stuff. So I said, well, listen, I wonder, is this as much as I could do? Or if I try harder, will I get more? You know, so it was, you know, as you go up, the stakes are higher. It gets harder.
For sure. I imagine that, okay, so obviously at some point there you went in and you read for The Sopranos and you ended up landing what started as a sort of fringe character in Bobby, right?
Yeah, I paid my own way. Paid my own way out there, put myself up. I joke, but it's the truth. I think I made $22,000. It cost me $24,000.
Wow.
I actually lost money, yeah. And the first year I did that, 6 episodes, and they would call and I would fly back. It wasn't easy. You know, it was hard.
I cannot imagine.
I still had the job. And the hotel was very nice about it. You know, they gave me a lot of leeway. So because there's a lot of stuff that can be done on the phone.
Sure.
You know, and you know what I used to do? Sometimes I would come in 9 in the morning, make sure the bosses saw me, and then I tell my secretary, I'm going to New York. If they come looking for me, I just left.
Right.
I swear to you. And I would do that, and I'd be gone missing 2-3 days. Nobody noticed.
It's funny, the Sopranos ended up being, for me, I mean, and so many people, millions of people around the world, their favorite television show, maybe of all time, right? And you're 12 years removed from that experience in the finale. I guess for you, being a part of it, what does the Sopranos mean to you? What did the show, that experience, how do you look back on it all now?
Well, listen, you know, when we were doing it, first of all, I at the beginning, I had no idea. I was just looking to get a couple lines.
Right.
You know, I just told this agent, I said, see if you get me. I'm going to New York for a wedding, man. I said, see if you get me to read, you know, read for something. So right. Then I read for an FBI agent. And then she said, it was Christopher Walken's wife. It was a casting director,
wow.
George Ann Walken. She said, I don't see you. Yeah, what are you nervous? It's just me and you here. I was a little nervous, you know. She said, what are you nervous about? It's just me and you. She said, read this. We have someone of mine. I read it, and then she looked at my resume. She said, what is this? Which is why people should never lie on their resume, because you'll get busted. And I said, listen, I've had 2-3 lines. You know, I was never an extra, but 2 lines here, 3 lines there, you know, little bit parts. And then she said, would you fly back to meet David Chase? And I wasn't going to go. My wife said, go ahead and go, you know, blah, blah, blah. Because I'm thinking, hey, it's going to cost me money. I got to fly to New York, put myself up. But they called the next day. They said I had it. And the agent, believe it or not, told me not to take it.
Wow.
Yeah. I said, well, why not? He said, well, they're not going to pay your way. It's a crappy deal. They're not going to put you up. It's going to cost you money. And I said, well, listen, man, I want to get, I was hating the job by now, you know, at the hotel. I said, I want to get out of this. I want to try, you know. So I did that for a year. You know, I did that for that season. I kept the job full time. And then I got a pilot with Nick Turturro. And I got hired on that. And my agent had the smarts to go to the Sopranos and say, Steve's about to take this job. Unless you make them a regular. And
there
that's when they made me a series regular, and they flew and they moved my family to New York, and they, you know, did all that stuff. So that was a really good phone call.
So was that
you
like
a handful
season 2?
Of great phone calls. That was, I started in June of 1999. I came on the second episode of the second season. So this was in 2000.
Okay.
It was season 3. I became a series regular.
And what was the first? Obviously, that went very well, and you grew from being sort of, like I said, a fringe character to like the closest thing to an everyman in Tony's inner circle. Like Bobby just brought some real sensitivity and regular, you know, non-sociopathic emotion to the cast. The Santa episode comes to mind as one with some unbelievably funny moments. I get, what did that feel? What was that like? Having a role on the fringe, sort of, to becoming a full-blown frontman, one of the central
focuses. I mean, you know, while it's happening, you don't really think in those terms, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, while it was happening, it was just, you know, believe it or not, I kind of did it backwards. So now I'm really working hard with an acting coach.
Right.
I'm working one-on-one with a guy who's a huge help to me. You know, I mean, I actually go to his apartment, we go over the stuff, and then I go to the set and do it. So I worked really hard to get where I was going. Okay. You know, the Jim, great actors, Dominic, who plays Uncle Junior. He was a huge help to me. He was very calming, you know, very calm presence. So, it starts growing and growing and growing. And I guess they liked what I did. You didn't get many pats on the back, you know,
okay.
It was kind of like, hey, man, I guess I'm doing okay. They're not killing me, though that really was a concern.
So no,
was a concern.
Nobody was coming up to you telling you, oh, Steve, you're doing an incredible job. We're going to continue your character bigger and bigger. It was just doing the job.
No, you're doing the job. You're getting paid and you're doing the job. And, you know, we're pros and that's what it is. You know, I mean, you don't need to every day tell you how blow smoke up your ass,
sure,
how great you are, and just go about your business. We became a very close group of friends, all of us. You know, there was a lot of traveling together and a lot of, parties and premieres.
I'm sure.
So we all became friends, our families, you know, the kids, you know, it really was a once in a lifetime kind of experience. Because most of the time, like every job, you go in, you're polite to everyone and you go home.
Right.
But this became, you know, more than that, you know.
Something bigger.
It was something way bigger. And my role got bigger and bigger and bigger, which was quite amazing because, honestly, I mean, I came out of nowhere. I never worked in New York, even though I'm from here. I didn't know any of those guys. You know, when I stepped on the set and met, you know, my first scene was with Tony Soprano, Paulie Walnuts, Silvio, and Big Pussy.
Main character.
And I mean, I'm going, you know, so that he's yelling at me in the pork store.
Yeah.
And then at some point.
You're standing by the fridge, right?
Yeah. And then later on, Jim says, let's go run lines. So here I am in the trailer with Uncle Junior, Tony Soprano, and me. And it's like an out-of-body experience. I'm going, how the hell did I get here? You know, because suddenly I'm in this guy's trailer and we're, you know, honestly. So it's like, what the hell? You know, I mean, so that stuff was weird. Suddenly people recognize you and all of that stuff was kind of odd.
So do you still get people yelling, you know, Bobby at you on the street?
Every single day.
Do you respond to that or you just give them a wave or what?
You know, it's almost they're nice. I mean, I'm okay with it. You know, I mean, I get a lot of Blue Bloods people now calling me Anthony. Yeah, you get a lot of that. The show, especially in New York, is very big. You know, I mean, you got 12 million people watching Blue Bloods every week and reruns. You know, you got to remember with The Sopranos at the time, not everyone had HBO,
right.
HBO Go and streaming, and it wasn't on Netflix and Hulu. So it was a much smaller audience watch The Sopranos. Now, you know, kids that are in their 20s that were too young to watch it,
yep.
There's a whole new generation watching.
So Blue Bloods, you mentioned, has been on for, I think, 10 seasons.
We just started filming our 10th season.
That's incredible.
Yeah,
I'm here in New York
filming that. It's a big deal.
And you've been on it since 2015, right?
Yeah. I came on in October. I was supposed to do one or two episodes. And I've done more Blue Blood episodes than Soprano.
Wow.
I've done 59 episodes. At Sopranos, I only did 53. I also was on another show after The Sopranos, Secret Life of the American Teenager, mm-hmm. with Shailene Woodley and Molly Ringwald.
Yeah.
Shailene is now a big star, Big Little Lies, and she makes big movies. And I did 110 episodes of that. So that was like Bridge the Gap, because I got that about 6 months after The Sopranos ended, you know.
What was the comparison there between working on a show for, say, CBS compared to working on an HBO production?
Well, HBO was almost like doing a movie every week.
Okay, that's what I figured.
And also, yeah, because, you know, you had 60 minutes with no commercials. You also, you know, as opposed to Blue Bloods, where you're doing the show and then it comes out 3 weeks later.
Right.
And it takes, you know, 9 days, 8 or 9 working days to shoot it. The Sopranos at the end, it was 17 days, 18 days
Whew.
To shoot 1 hour show.
Man, that's a lot of work.
You know, it's a big difference. It's also a big difference, you know, a 1 hour show on network TV is really 42 minutes.
Right.
41 minutes, you know, that's all you get because of the commercials. So that's the difference. And then The Sopranos also would... we would shoot them all. They would all be in the can, and then they would come out.
Right.
Two different ways of doing things, you know. So HBO, I mean, David Chase had complete autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as Blue Bloods, I mean, great acting. The streets of New York are like another character, not unlike New Jersey was.
Sure.
You know, the different kind of show, but solid show, and it's all in the writing, man. It's all about the writing.
You're speaking about writing. You've actually written several books at this point. First of all, you're making the rest of us look bad, but what made you want to go into the writing route?
You know, I always thought, honestly, that writing a book was a huge accomplishment. You know, I mean, I always thought that from when I was a kid. I'm a big, big reader. I've always been a big reader since I'm a kid.
Okay.
Always. All kinds of, mostly biographies I like. I like nonfiction stuff, biographies, sports books. But since I'm a young kid. And so when I was approached to do a kind of a cookbook, it didn't really work out that way. You know, it kind of, we were approached and then somewhere along the line, we went a different route and telling these stories of Gumba's Guide to Life,
right.
Funny Italian-American stories. And just from my, it was not a memoir, but just my experiences. And then it's one of them things, you know, my storyline got really big. It was season 4, like in November.
On The Sopranos,
it was like,
yeah.
2002. And I got to tell you, the stars lined up, man. I started doing press. I mean, this struck a chord with people. I mean, I'm doing book signings. 500-600 people are showing up.
Whew.
I mean, it's the most incredible thing ever. All over New Jersey, we're doing 2 signings a day and selling tons of books. And then I'm on the Today Show, and then I get a call to do the Tonight Show. And we go number 4 on, you know, we wind up number 4 on Amazon. And I say to my editor, I said, man, any way we're going to be a bestseller? She said, no, we'll never do it. And I wind up becoming number 13 on New York Times bestseller
That's
list.
Awesome.
And that first book, yeah, it was just one of them things, man. The storyline got big. I remember my publishers called and said, you know, I think I was in St. Louis. She said, turn around. Going to do the Tonight Show tomorrow night. And it was like just one of those things.
That's
and
so
then,
funny.
And then I did 2 other Gumba books. And then I wrote a kid's book, Nikki Deuce, which we turned into a movie.
I saw that.
For Nickelodeon. And it's one of Jim Gandolfini's last movies. There's 5 Sopranos. That's as
wow.
close as you're going to get to a Soprano reunion. And we shot that. It's a kid movie, but very proud of that and happy. And then my last book was about raising daughters, and that was in 2013. That was a great book, and I just, you know, I've thought about maybe another one. I just don't have any ideas, man.
It's a lot of energy to write a book, a lot of time.
It's a lot of energy to write it, but it's even more energy, believe it or not, to promote it.
Ah.
That's the energy. That's the hard. That's really a hard part to get people to read your book, you know, you know, and nowadays especially. But, you know, and I was lucky enough to be able to get on TV and you know, promoted as opposed to some authors. But it was a good experience. It's a tough business, the book business. You know, you have to. They got to pay more. I don't know, people don't know this, but, you know, when you walk into a Barnes & Noble, you know, Barnes & Noble picks, it's on the table, you know, you got to pay for that.
Yep.
And to have your book turned the other way, you got to pay. It's like a supermarket.
It is.
You know, you got to pay for placement. So
You mentioned Big Little Lies and Shailene Woodley and how you worked with her. One of the characters on Big Little Lies has like a train set obsession, and that felt to me like a little nod to Bobby almost. Did you ever find yourself itching to go pick up a new caboose from the toy store, or did Bobby's obsession?
I'm not a train guy.
So that didn't translate to real life.
You know, it was a huge train guy.
Who?
And I was at his house years ago, Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
At his house. Not that we were buddies. We weren't buddies, but I was good friends with a friend of his, and he passed away, and we were at his house for the after the funeral, and Sinatra had square foot bungalow on his property, 1 complete train set.
That's incredible.
A huge train set. And once you were in his house, you know, you could just walk around anywhere.
Wow.
So he had, you know, a bunch of different pools and this and that. And I just was walking on the grounds. I think it was 4 acres. And he had this huge train set with the train going. And yeah, he was a train guy.
Let me ask you, season 6, episode 13, maybe the most epic Bobby episode ever with the fight scene in the cabin. And that's 2 big men going at it. What was filming that fight with Mr. Gandolfini like? And I heard you accidentally headbutted him.
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, we were upstate, the 4 of us, for a couple of weeks, you know, shooting that. And it was in July. So we go to shoot the fight scene. And Jim, I guess in the off season, had gotten operated on one knee or both knees.
Right.
He said, you know what? I'm not going to be able to do this. I can't do this properly. This isn't going to work. So 6 months later in January, on the set of Silver Cup Studios, they rebuilt that cabin.
Wow.
Now that cabin was owned by, Schneider, you know, French Connection, Jaws.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
What's his name?
Oh my God.
You know, great actor. What's it? Not, I don't know. I'm going blank.
Yeah, oh, Roy Schneider.
Roy Schneider. Great. So that was his house, and I guess his wife got it in the divorce.
Okay.
And she would rent it out for shoots, and it was right on that lake. Okay, and we were up there, and so now we're back 6 months later. It's in the middle of the winter. I walk onto the stage, and you go, this is incredible. It's almost creepy, because it's exactly how the cabin, they rebuilt it. It cost $250,000.
Wow.
They rebuilt this cabin for this fight scene. And it took us a day and a half. We did 95% of the stunts are us. You know, Jim said, we're good friends. Let's try to go as far as we can without killing each other.
Sure.
So it was two fat, out-of-shape guys. that's what you see. Yeah, there was a point where I zigged, he zagged. I headbutted him, and he went down. And he took a break for about an hour and a half. He broke the cartilage, but we continued. And the next day, I remember the second day, because it was a day and a half. I mean, I could barely move. I was so sore, but I think it was it looked good. You know, I think it was
it was powerful.
It was real. You know, it was real. Yeah. That's where that, like I said, 6 months later, it's pretty amazing.
That's incredible. I've got one more question that's Sopranos related. I'm sure you get an unbelievable amount of these, but did you really go grab a giant dildo and stick it down your pants to get a genuine laugh out of James?
Yeah, because I we were up doing the Pine Barrens, and
my favorite episode ever, by the way.
Yeah, we did the Pine Barrens, so we shot that upstate, and you know he saw me with the Elmer Fudd outfit there, he said, "Man, we got to work tomorrow morning. I don't know how I'm going to laugh at 7 o'clock."
Right.
So the next morning, I go to the prop guy, and I don't tell anyone.
Right.
Steve Buscemi was directing it. I don't tell Steve. I don't tell anybody. And I say, you got something? What could I do? So the guy gave me a dildo, giant dildo, 3 foot long. And when I turn the corner, which is off camera, I'm twirling that around. And you could, that's what Jim's laughing at. And you could almost see Uncle Junior crack.
Oh.
If you look at it again, you'll see him almost crack.
I got to go watch it.
And then I was wearing a Rastafarian wig, and I was coming up with all kinds of shit.
God.
Yeah, that's a true story.
Would you do me the honor of saying one line for me? From The Sopranos, just one. The Quasimodo predicted all of this.
Oh, I don't know if I want to say that.
Such a good.
But that
line.
Now that scene. So you see that scene. Listen. You see all the food. You see the eating. It's all real stuff.
Uh-huh.
I ate 6 ribeye steaks during that scene.
6.
I'm kid you not.
It's excessive.
I kid you not. You know, because once you start eating, take after take after take, and
that's how it goes.
I just
sometimes
kept on eating the steaks. Yeah.
To the victor belong the spoils, right?
Yeah. There you go. That was in my very first scene when I was walking out the door.
Unreal, Mr. Steve.
I'll tell you another thing. You know,
yeah.
When I saw the script, I saw all these fat jokes.
Uh huh.
You're a cow's own with legs.
Sure.
You know, we'll shove your quotation book up your fat fucking ass.
Right.
All these things that I said to my wife, I wonder if they hired the wrong guy, because I'm not that much fatter than Jim.
Sure.
They were about the same size. And sure enough, they called me a few days before. They said, we forgot to tell you, you need to come in and get fitted for a fat suit.
That's an experience.
And I came in, and the first two seasons I wore a fat suit.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. And then I guess the third season I got, fat enough on my own, I didn't have to wear it.
That has to be the funniest day of your life, the day you show up to the set and nobody brings you out your suit and you're going, excuse me.
No, I was there for wardrobe. And I was outside, and David Chase had walked in. I said hello to him, and then the wardrobe lady came down and said, you don't have to wear the fat suit anymore. So I said, okay. It was a little too big and a little too obvious.
Of course,
you know,
no, that makes
to
sense.
To be honest, you know, the first two seasons, I got a little head with this big, huge thing. The first year, it was like a makeshift thing. The second year, they sent me to a costume, Broadway costume place, a real place.
Yeah, I saw
you know?
One
but,
of the...
I have it. I have the fat suit.
No
I
way.
Have one of them. Yeah, I have it in my garage in California.
At one point, they were trying to auction it off somewhere for like $1,000 or something. I'm glad you ended up with it.
I have it here.
That is awesome. Mr. Steve Sciarippa, we very much appreciate, again, you taking the time. It was an honor and a pleasure. Best of luck
sure,
with all your
buddy.
Ventures.
Nice talking to you.
We look forward to seeing what's next from you. It meant a lot. Seriously, thank you.
Appreciate it, man. Take care.
You too. Pretty cool, huh? Pretty cool. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed Mr. Steve Sciarippa. I hope you enjoyed this special, teaser of the Ross Bolin podcast here on the OCC Oysters, Clams, and Cockles feed. Obviously, we'll be back with more OCC on Wednesday to talk more Succession. Episode 7 is going to have aired on Sunday. We're going to be diving further into Amazon's The Boys. Those of you who are caught up are aware, we've started The Boys, Season 1. We knocked out episode 1. Super, super psyched on this show. Incredible so far. We've got a couple new shows we're watching, actually. For those of you who are on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles, we are also starting The Righteous Gemstones, which has been freaking hilarious so far. Very surprised by the quality of that show. A lot going on with OCC this week, so you've got that to look forward to. But until then, subscribe to the Ross Bolin podcast on Apple Podcasts. Follow on Spotify, listen on SoundCloud, and then have yourself a great weekend, Clam Fam. Enjoy your TV shows and your movies. Adios, muchachos.